Blog Talk Radio.
You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison, here on Blog Talk Radio. And whether you're on the phone line, on the internet, on a podcast, listening, chatting, blogging, listening to us live, or reviewing one of our archives, we are so happy to have you with us. For those of you who'd like to call in, the call-in number is 347-426-3895. And if we have time, we may open up the phone lines later in the show. And for those of you who'd like to chat, please join our chat room. It is open, but you must be registered with Blog Talk to chat in our chat room. Tonight, our topic is motivating teen and preteen readers, how teachers and parents can lead the way. Our guest is the author of this book and has been creating original curricula in reading, writing, thinking, poetry, creativity, vocabulary, concentration, and emotional intelligence for many years. Welcome, Jeffrey Flom. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm fine. Doing fine. Thank you for having me on the show, Andrea.
Wow. Have you been doing some very comprehensive work?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you would please share with us a bit about your journey as a reader and at what point in your life did you realize the importance of reading?
I was always into books and always traveling around bookstores and looking for different titles, mostly for a long time, and even now, fiction. I found there used to be what was called a discount, very big discount book chain, and I once found the book Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach, which was a big bestseller in the, I think, the early 70s, and I took a stack of about 40 of them, hardbacks, and used it for a novel to teach my kids, fifth and sixth grade kids. You know, and basically making up questions and visualizations and getting them into...
Now, that was as an adult, correct, that particular book?
Yes.
Right. So what was your favorite book when you were growing up? Did you have a favorite when you were a child? And why was it your favorite?
I think the books that by Salinger, his short stories, Franny and Zoe, and later on in high school, Hess, Herman Hess, and Kurt Vonnegut, were strong books for me, and now mostly I read people like Haruki Murakami, 1Q84, which is a big bestseller in Japan, and he has a big following here. Anything that was imaginative and creative, and you know, made you think and made you see a lot of things. Was the type of book that, you know, I like to read.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, your interest and excitement about reading inspired you to go into education, correct?
Yes. I went into education. Well, I actually, Andrea, my background was in psychology. And I took also background in English courses as well, lit, American lit, English lit, and I went into teaching. It wasn't my first choice, But when I did get into it, I wanted to write. And so I started teaching, and I said, okay, fine. At 3 o'clock when I get home, I'll start writing. But I blew most of my energy in the classroom, and so I gave up my writing and developed writing programs for the kids.
Yeah.
And I just made up stuff. That's because I was not happy with what they had, Basel readers and scripted questions. It wasn't working. It wasn't working for me. I wasn't motivated, so I couldn't see the kids being motivated. So that, you know, my own feelings about literature and the emotions that are connected with it were all funneled into my own creativity, and so to get the kids into theirs.
Yeah, now let's talk about the power of words and the value in reading. Can you just reflect on that?
Well, one of the questions that I asked the kids in the book, you know, what do words mean to you? Do you see them just as black on white? And I try to get them to see the ideas behind the words, the thoughts, the meanings, the experiences connected, the mind pictures, the feelings. And I work on this pretty much from a single word, like duck, and move on to like two-word sentences. When I do, like, for instance, I'll do a sentence, a two-word sentence, boys fight. And I'll have the kids describe what they see, the emotions connected, the thoughts connected. And then I'll take a surreal sentence to show them what their imagination can do. And I'll say, give a sentence like children float or trees dance. You know, and the minute I say that, they start laughing. And because they saw the image, it was a silly image. And it shows them, you know, what their imagination can do, what I call the self-amusement park of the imagination, where they can play.
Right. So now, what about just reading an old-fashioned book? Did you get them interested in just reading books, or did you find that they were more interested in the imagery that you were creating for them just by speaking as opposed to reading?
Well, that is reading. The reading is translating the words into images, or what I call mind pictures, feelings and thoughts and meaning.
Right.
And that I really didn't care if it was a paragraph, a page long passage, or a short story or a novel. I read a lot of short stories by Hemingway with the kids, and a lot of poetry by Langston Hughes. And
but did they seem to react more when you read to them, or when they were reading themselves, or?
Oral reading, you know, that's, you know, great. I mean, I think that that's a big thing that, you know, parents can really do so the kids can hear the sound of the language and visualize at the same time. But my thing was more that they're working independently. Because they want to.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, because that was what I was going to ask you. You know, how do you inspire young people to read? You know, how do you inspire them? And especially when there's so much outside stimuli, such as television, and now, of course, we have the texting, you know, the cell phones and the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, just how do you get kids to focus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. My thing, Andrea, is intrinsic motivation, inner motivation, self-motivation. the part and parcel of the book, the 1,000 questions, is to make the an adolescent think about his or her reading life and reading life experiences, and to get into them for better or for worse. If she hates it, you know, fine. Let her see what, you know, what's not working, and let the person confront, you know, their reading demons. So I don't want my journey is not to make them read, but to have them find their motivation to read, because I'm not going to lead a horse to water and make him drink. That's not where it's at. You know what I did in the room.
Well, I read some of the writings of your students, and it seemed to me that your class probably would be fun for most students. I mean, that's the feeling that I had from, you know, reading the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're talking about the contemplation or the music writing,
right.
Originally, Andrea, I used this approach after lunch when the kids came back. You know, it was basically riot conditions in the cafeteria. You know, they were eating, having a great time. And then when they came up to the room for another 2 hours, you know, they weren't exactly ready to work. So I put on music for 10 minutes, and I started playing Billy Joel. You know, it wasn't the kids' favorites. You know, eventually, you know, they would come up to me and say, "You really like this guy?" I mean, you know, and eventually they got to like him too, because they had no choice. But I changed that tune, and because I felt that they were just listening and relaxing, which was fine, but I also wanted some academics. If an administrator walked in, they wouldn't appreciate just at that time. You got to remember, in the 70s and 80s, in 90s, this wouldn't be, you know, a great thing. So I handed out. Now I'm going back to boom boxes and audio cassette tapes.
You right.
Know, dinosaur days. You know, and I gave the kids blank tapes. I said, "Okay, here, you record a mix for us that you know the rest of the kids will like, and I'll play it."
Right.
Yeah, and so I played music for about 10 minutes, and then I handed out like 4x6 index cards, and I said, "Well, write whatever came into your mind while the music was playing."
Yeah.
Just write it out. And
Do you think that the traditional book is gone for most kids now? You know, with the electronic books and with everything, do you think it's kind of becoming a dinosaur?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I mean, I have a Kindle, and I like it, but I also have 8,000 million books here that I'm always shuttling off to a used bookstore to keep emptying it out. But I think that there'll still be a need for books. I see art books, and how are they going to – what are they going to do, produce a Kindle that's 10 by 14 inches so you can have, you know, art books? I don't think it's going to be a perfect transition totally, but, I mean, it is heading that way. I mean, they're putting textbooks, school textbooks on electronic books, so you know, a lot of it will be funneled in that direction.
I was speaking to a woman the other day, and she was telling me about, I don't know if, I think it was her 11-year-old granddaughter, and she was saying, or grandson, that he doesn't read books. Only looks at electronic books right now, and I thought that's interesting at 11.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
If that trend keeps going, for the most part, that means a lot of kids won't even really know what an actual paperback book is, or a hardcover.
Right.
which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, that's cool. If he's reading on a Kindle or a Nook, that's great. As long as he's you know reading, that's cool. I mean, I don't object to that. But you know, they talk about the feel of a book, and you know, it's a different experience as opposed to a Kindle. It's a more colder experience holding on to an electronic device as opposed to a book, more friendly, more user-friendly in that sense. So
yeah.
Either way, I mean, a lot of the books that they make now are on recycled paper, so after you read it, after a year, it's laying on the bookshelf, the paper, you know, turns brown and is crumbling as it is. So
right, yeah. I wanted to read a little bit from your book,
mm-hmm.
unless you wanted to read it.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, on page one, I wanted to read, and a little bit into page two,
mm-hmm.
because you talk about one key to improving reading intrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Motivation meant something when I started teaching in an inner city school in the late 60s. 30 minutes to inspire the class, add vocabulary words from Basel readers, and the race began. To find the motivation that channel into a story became a challenge. After the preliminaries, the room turned quiet, relaxed, yet full of enthusiasm. Look at their eyes, their noses, and the books. The kids were off to reading Wonderland. Motivating children to read came mostly from the outside. How can teachers hold students' attention, make them readers and lifelong readers, with less intrusion from the outside? Reading is an internal process, a world of solitude, peace, delight, and grace. After all, the oral readings, book clubs, small group reading, class discussions, and testing. How kids deal with themselves inside their reading worlds and imaginations becomes significant in reading today. You may want to stop and ask, who has the time for elaborate internal motivations when I have to raise reading scores? How much thought can I give to my class's reading sanctuaries, let alone their minds and imaginations? Reading in the 2000s is functional to get grades or standardized tests. You will get no arguments from me. Reading now means drills, skills, and less thrills. And don't forget the electro-techno world. How can reading compete with iPods, video, computer games, DVDs, CDs, and the internet? Statistics show us losing readers after the fourth grade. In fact, interest in reading decreases through high school. Leisure time reading goes down for most adolescents to less than 10 minutes a day. To change this situation, return to motivation, not so much from the outside, but from the inside, or to inner or self-motivation. Happy readers entertain themselves in reading's lonely pleasures and will continue throughout life. When students search for and learn more about reading experiences, processes, and the imagination, where all this stuff resides, they will rejuvenate their reading and reading lives. Yeah, I thought that was a powerful little open there.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I was saying, did I write this here?
And then you go on to talk about Michael, a reluctant
mm-hmm.
reader,
mm-hmm.
Whose dad is buying book after book, yet he has no interest in reading. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? I mean, that must be really frustrating to keep buying him a book. And then the picture, the illustration, is like, oh, please. I mean, it's like,
Yeah. First, since you mentioned the illustration, I should say that the artist is James Jajak. And James is a teacher. He's an art teacher in Williamsburg and extremely talented artist and a cartoonist. He's unbelievable. So that picture is incredible. The story with Michael, it's an actual story, and the father came up on open school night and was really frustrated, and, you know, he just didn't understand it, and you just can't pile up books and expect, you know, a child to pick up a book. That's all about making him read from the outside. Buy all these beautiful books, and Michael is going to read the book. Well, he just wasn't interested in reading anything. And so that's what I call an extrinsic motivation. And I wanted to go on the inside and get Michael to read because he wants to read. And so the questions that I pose to Michael will be on his early experience, like an early book that he read that he liked, or what was it like when you first learned how to read? What goes on inside Michael's head when he does read? What feelings are intervening with his reading process? And I get him into words and make him think about words and how they trigger images and feelings and thoughts. But again, I'm not afraid to have Michael confront his demons and see what's really affecting him and why he. It's a psychological approach, an emotional intelligence approach to find the intrapersonal responses and experiences that are going on that might be tripping him up. And after a year, let's say, of maybe 100 questions, I think that he might get the message where he's at and, you know, what he might want to do in his reading life to inspire himself, you know, from within.
So can you just talk about the intrinsic motivation? Can you explain that term for our audience?
Mm-hmm.
I think we've been talking about it all the time, but if you could just kind of define it.
Mm-hmm. It's inner motivation. He has to see what he's reading. He has to be able to visualize the imagery, to realize that his imagination, he's recreating the imagination of the writer in his head. And he has to work at finding these pictures, seeing the details, getting the triggered feelings, you know, from it, and that's where the intrinsic motivation comes. He has, Michael has an inner eye that's looking at the pictures being flashed on an imaginary TV screen in his mind. There's an imaginary inner, a silent reading voice that's reading the words to him inside his head. And of course, if there's an inner reading voice, there's got to be an inner ear, not the actual physical inner ear, but the imaginary inner ear that's listening to all this here. It's about the process. If Michael can see and understand and appreciate this process, he'll start. My bet is that he'll be motivated from the inside, not from a stack of brand new books that are meaningless to him.
Right. So, which I guess that's why you said earlier, if they're reading something, even if it's on the internet, that's a good start. The fact that they're, if it's a magazine or whatever,
mm-hmm.
comic books or,
mm-hmm.
It's at least they're reading.
right. Yeah. I mean, but you know, there's a point. You know, I get into concentration with the kids. That's another skill that's just taken for granted, assumed. And I not only do I want them to visualize an image, but I want them to have the concentration to stay with it and really appreciate it. I'm not, you know, my lessons lasted a long time. And once a teacher walked by my room and the kids were reading, And he said, this is like a, you know, like a prayer that looks, the kids look like they're praying. I said, that's it. I love that. That's right. They're, you know, they're in prayer. You know, that,
they were worshiping those books. Right.
Right. And I took that as a complete compliment. But I want that, you know, not that ADD, you know, attention deficit disorder. That's all about a fragment of the kids coming with fragmented consciousness, you know, from watching TV or very, you know, short internet blurbs and stuff like that. I'm trying to extend their concentration. And I really rather have them, you know, staying with their reading. And, not, you know, comic books are fine and, you know, they have their place, but I'm still into more serious reading with them. And you know what the joke is? At the end of the day, Andrea, with all the test scores and the manipulations of the scores and the tests and everything else and the test obsession,
right?
The percentage of kids that are going entering college as freshmen, it's a huge. I read at one point 50% of the kids, and I'm not sure of that, but it's a very, very high percentage, cannot read the college textbooks.
Oh, yeah, I've spoken to college professors who said that it was frustrating.
Right.
That a lot of the kids who are freshmen in college, not only can they not read, and of course they can't write either. So, I mean, actually the two seem to be very much tied together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, what it's interesting, so what I like about your work is that you go for the unmotivated reader to get them to read, and then trying to get them to open up and to share and to participate in a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? What's your approach to asking questions that inspires the unmotivated student to engage? Because I would imagine as they begin engaging, they're getting excited, which means they're interested. And certainly interest is probably most of the battle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, the questions, I think, in and of themselves, are I would like to think, is my opinion, are pretty motivating. They're more original, creative. There's a lot of absurd questions there and a lot of challenging questions. So basically, I want to drop them inside their mind and imagination to places where they're going to have to roam around and find answers, to things that nobody's ever asked them, to questions that nobody's, you know, given them time to think about.
Right.
Then, all right, that's like the first part. But then once they come up with an answer, it's your job as a teacher and discussion leader or a parent to try to expand what they say. So, for example, why do you like to read? I'm just picking up any question. And the student says, oh, it's fun. You know, then I would go into fun. What do you mean by fun? Fun is this, this, or that. And as you ask me, what's a fun book that, you know, you've read recently, and why was it fun? And, you know, what else is there about fun that, what else motivates you to read? So you really have to extract, you know, a lot of information out of the kids, as opposed to imparting everything to the kids. It's coming from them, and that's drawing also the motivation from them, the inner or intrinsic motivation or self-motivation, that this is an organic approach. It's coming from their worlds.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking in your book. You have the voice you hear when you read silently.
Mm-hmm.
It's not silent. It is a speaking out loud voice in your head. It is spoken. A voice is saying it as you read. It's the writer's words. Of course, in a literary sense, his or her voice, but the sound of that voice is the sound of your voice, not the sound your friends know or the sound of a tape played back, but your voice caught in the dark cathedral of your skull,
mm-hmm.
your voice heard by an internal ear, informed by internal abstracts, and what you know by feeling, having felt, it is your voice saying, for example, the word barn that the writer wrote, but the barn, you say, is a barn you know or knew,
mm-hmm.
the voice in your head, speaking as you read, never says anything neutrally. Some people hated the barn they knew. Some
mm-hmm.
people love the barn they know. So you hear the word loaded, and a sensory constellation is lit. Horse gnawed stalls, hayloft, black heat tape wrapping, a water pipe, a slippery spilled sure of oats from a split sack, the bony, filthy haunches of cows, and
mm-hmm.
barn is only a noun, no verb or subject has entered into the sentence yet. The
mm-hmm.
voice you hear when you read to yourself is the clearest voice you speak it, speaking
mm-hmm.
to you. Thomas Lux,
mm-hmm.
that was, yeah.
Yes, yeah, that, when I saw that poem, it just hit home, and to me, that should be read and memorized, even though I'm not big into memorization, but every kid in elementary school, in, let's say, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, should read that poem and get tuned in to what this inner, the silent inner reading voice is. And that is very important to the whole reading process, because if you can't hear that voice and hear the intonations, the emotions, hooked into that voice, you know, reading's a bummer. I mean, there's no fun.
You talked about music, how you were playing music, and so can music inspire reading?
Yeah, well, my daughter, when she was studying, constantly had music on. I don't know. For me, I'm so internal. I could put some background music on.
Right.
And I think the kids now also can handle multi-sensory experiences. So they can be reading a book and have, you know, music on, and that's also seen as a way to inspire reading and thinking and creativity, because reading is an art like writing. You consider
right.
writing an art, but people don't think about reading as an art, but it is, because it's all about imagination and, as I was saying before, this recreation of the writer's imagination. That's what you do in your head. And if you're not doing that, what are you doing when you read?
Yeah, true.
I had one of my kids, she's now in NYU in speech language pathology, is in graduate school. A brilliant kid. I'm hopefully get a chance to maybe read one of her poems and contemplations. And her daughter's in the fourth grade now, and she said, "Oh, Mr. Flaum, I can't, you know, Zoe, she read Chloe reads. She can read all the words, but no comprehension."
Ah, yeah,
yeah. And that's another big issue where they, you know, focus on the mechanics of reading and not the meaning and motivation that's there, and this inner process of reading that it enables kids to, you know, visualize what's going on. And because they can't, they're just not putting the words together, even though they could read the words, and there could be also other distractions.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, when you talk to older people, they'll say, "Well, you know, I just went to school. You know, we had to read a book. We just read the book. We read it, and now it's. I wonder, is there more coaxing and needed to entice young people to read, and is it because there's just so much for them to do?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because, yeah, when you talk to older, we just read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they gave us the book, we read it, and that was that. Because the whole issue of concentration now, with so much going on, how do you get someone to concentrate? Or maybe it's because there is so much stimuli now, they're used to it, and they can do it because they can block so much out, you know? Mm.
No, I don't, you know, they, as you were saying before, there is a lot of competition for their mind and imagination from
right.
video games and everything else. But the worst part of it is that their concentration is broken down. Not in a video game, that they can, you know, sit there and play for hours, but in reading there's intermittent concentration, and concentration is a skill that's developed. I have a whole series of concentration exercises that I use with the kids. For example, one of the things we did as kids when we were totally bored out of our brains was the staring game. Did you ever play the staring game with a friend? And all you
no.
do is, yeah.
What's the staring game?
Yeah, okay. So the staring contest. Whatever, you know, and what we would do is we would sit facing each other, eyeball to eyeball, and look at each other, and the first one that laughed or, you know, made a face or flinched, lost, you know, but when you stared at the person, there were no faces, it's just staring eyeball to eyeball.
Right,
and it was hilarious, and I did it with the kids in the class, and you know, they did it for, I don't know, maybe 5-10 minutes. That was the activity, and then I asked them afterwards, well, describe what happened to yourself. Oh God, what they wrote about their friends, their faces was hilarious, you know. But I asked them, so well. What happened? How did you lose your concentration? What happened there? And how did you get your concentration back? And so this was kind of a novelty approach that got them to start thinking about concentration, of making it stronger, more intense, and when they lose it, and how they can bring it back, you know, to the word on the page or to looking at their friend.
Right. I mean, actually, when you think about just to do certain things throughout life, I mean, concentration is very important. Mm. You know, to have that focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, and then yeah, I really find it so disturbing that kids are going all through school, graduating,
mm-hmm.
going to college, and they still can't read or write. I mean, how on earth does that happen? And then they're getting through college and they can't read and write. And so what does that mean?
I'm sorry.
I'm wondering what that means for our world. If people can actually graduate from high school and college and still not really be able to read or write.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's kind of scary to me.
It is scary. It's scary because one of the issues here is the testing, and they've lost their educational minds with the obsession about testing, and they're not really worried about whether the kid enjoys reading or not. And there's a lot of manipulation on the tests, and you know, I think a lot of the parents are given a false bill of goods when they hear about the test scores. And the bottom line at the end of the day, Andrea, is the kid picking up a book and reading it because he wants to and he enjoys reading? If he's reading 15 minutes a day after school, nothing to do with school, that's the bottom line. And when you keep test prepping them, drill and kill, you're knocking out the motivation. You're getting the kids to dislike reading and to do anything but read. It's not an option after school.
It's something, though. Really, it's very.
And they can't also, if they're not interpreting the information, if they can't critically interpret information from textbooks, that's bringing us to a world of Big Brother and That's what scares me. That without this ability to critically think and to think creatively, to concentrate and focus, that's you know leaving us at kind of loose ends for what's you know going to be in the future.
Yeah, I'm wondering now, let's talk about the, if a child's unmotivated to read, are the challenges the same whether they're homeschooled or not? Because a lot of, there's a growing movement of homeschooled children. And do you know anything about that in terms
yes.
of?
Yes, yes. Well, I think the homeschooling teacher parents, what I call them, are looking for, you know, programs, projects, curricula to motivate their kids, and I think there's over 2 million kids now that are being homeschooled, and all these stats, Andrea, on them is that they do very very well when they get into college. I mean, and
why do you think that is?
You can't beat one-to-one, parent to child. A one-to-one relationship. My wife tutors a sixth-grade girl in math and who has multiple issues, physical issues, and she just was able to remove her math block and really able to help her become confident. You get that in a one-to-one that you can't get necessarily in a classroom unless you have a really strong teacher in front where each kid feels one-to-one with the teacher, even though there are 35 kids, which I had. I had 35, 37 kids for 5 years straight in a room. And but
how important is confidence, too? Yeah.
Yeah, major. Major, and they call it now, and I was looking it up, self-efficacy, self-belief, and that's the word I use, the phrase self-belief. And I looked it up online, and then I see they translate it as self-efficacy, and there's a huge movement, you know, that very much involved with you know with confidence. Yeah,
right.
I think that's. Major, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's again that's
and that's
that,
part
that's
of the motivational process, right?
Yes.
It's making them feel confident, because if they feel confident, then they'll do it, won't they?
Right. That's right. That's part of the inner intrinsic motivation, and a lot of kids are very shaky, you know, about reading, and they've had. Let's say bad experiences early on. They weren't such great readers. When they read out loud in class, you know, they're not sounding that great. And there's a lot of embarrassment there, and that can set a kid back a long way in terms of confidence. And that's a big part of a reading teacher's ability is to restore confidence, or a math teacher or tutor, making a child just feel good about themselves and that they can move on.
Yeah. And what about students suffering from ADD or ADHD?
Yeah.
Those challenges are even greater, right?
Definitely. There is a section there for parents with ADD and ADHD kids, and I'm claiming, although it's not proven or it's not tested, this is just an educational guess. I feel that the questions will slow them down, and also get them into the process, the reading process, what goes on in their heads, and the psychological process that's also going on at the same time, and it will really slow them down. Now, I ran this by a friend who has been in special ed for many years. He's a mediator a conflict mediator, and I asked him, "What do you think?" And he wasn't so sure that this would work with ADD or ADHD kids, but I think it would, and especially if you combine, for example, what I was talking about, the concentration exercises. I think this is just a malady from game playing, TV, and all the surreal imagery that kids see. They want to be entertained to the limit. One of my friends said, "Jeff, if I was on TV teaching, the kids would really enjoy the lessons a lot more."
Yeah.
But I think that can be dealt with not medically, with Ritalin. It could be done in a inquiry based approach, and where you learn to slow the child down mentally, that he or she can concentrate.
Yeah. So let's talk about now reading and imagination, and of course creativity and imagination.
Okay. Let me see. I was talking a little bit about words and word activity questions.
Right.
I started this again. I did this years ago, and starting out with single words, and moving into two word sentences, 4 to 6 word sentences, longer sentences, and then paragraphs, and where the kids are visualizing everything and also tacking on whatever emotions or thoughts.
Right.
Any experiences are connected with what they read. So,
yeah.
For example, I use one of the questions is just says snow. What do you see, feel, think, and wonder? And that's a charged word, obviously. And forget it. They'll get into all sorts of things about snow and all sorts of experiences, and to show that words have an emotional response as well as a cerebral response.
And it's interesting. I noticed how you mentioned snow, and this is something that the kids could all relate to because they've seen it, they've felt it. Mm-hmm. They've walked in it, How important is that, creating imagery of things that they can relate to?
Right. Yeah, it's all about that. It's all about connecting what's in the book and what's in their life and their experiences. I think it's important to connect to your own experience. I know whenever I read somebody, you were asking me before, I have to connect with something that writer is talking about. And when I do, when it connects with my life, I jump, I say, hey,
right.
This is me here. I've gone through this here. And
that happens at every age, regardless of whether you're
yes.
a young child learning to read or an adult who's
right.
been reading for years.
Right.
It's
yes.
important to have those connections.
Right. Yes. Here's a question. What words do you use to pump yourself up in sports? Now, sports are major. It's a major activity. It was when I was a kid. And again, how can words get you into the game and thinking positively? So again, I'm showing them yes the connection between what you're saying to yourself, the self-talk, and playing a sport, and it can relate to any sports book. This idea of competition and how to challenge yourself and keep yourself concentrating.
Right.
They once asked Martina Navratilova, the tennis player, what do you do? when you lose your concentration. And her answer was, I concentrate on concentrating, you know, which, you know, and I just love, I mean, you know, that was just like, yeah, right. That's, you know, that's
yeah, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. I have phrases certain phrases or expressions really pop out in the mind. Use your imaginary inner eye to view the following, and then write a short description of each image you see. Include your thoughts and feelings for each phrase. Broken glass, puffy clouds, angry eyes. And, if I ask you this question, Andrea, did you ever see a blue apple? Well, right away, you know, you'll say immediately, no, and, you know.
Right.
I never, but you got the picture.
Exactly.
You said all of a sudden, you know, oh, a blue apple. What is he talking about? So this is, you know, if it's verbal or it's off a page, you got to see the pictures. You ain't seeing the pictures. You ain't seeing nothing.
You said that, I was immediately. I looked at a red. I could see a red apple, and then I was trying to imagine the red apple being blue.
Right.
And
right.
I think to myself, that's kind of strange. But yeah, but I could see the imagery immediately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you said that, you know,
right.
the.
Right. Right.
So it's interesting how the color. Yeah, that's an interesting exercise.
I take kids out of their comfort zone and drop them inside the middle of their imagination in a place where they haven't been.
Right.
And then, you know, that triggers another image and, oh, yeah, yeah, a blue apple, you know, a purple apple, whatever. And they start seeing how the imagination works. I'll give you I do an exercise where I think I use a candle. I light a candle in front of the room, and I have the kids stare at the candle for, I don't know, 30 seconds, let's say. And then I ask them to, after they've stared at the candle, to close their eyes. And then they all go nuts. Oh, I see the candle. I still see, my eyes are closed. I still see the candle. And that's the visual after effect of the experience, that it's become a mind picture in your head.
Yeah, so, it's like you really can see it. It's
right.
Yeah, that's really great. So tell me, is there good reading and bad reading, or is all reading positive in terms of stimulating imagination and developing the intellect?
That's a good question. I have a hard time, for instance, the Harry Potter books. I mean, I've read parts of some of them, and it's become a phenomenon with the kids and stuff. But I think the movies are better, are much better. If the reading works on the imagination and the kids, you know, feel it, and they have what they call a response to literature, a strong response, you know, I feel that that's important. But I prefer quality over quantity. Like in the New York City Department of Education, the kids have to read a certain amount of books each year.
Right.
It might be 30 books. I think they do it all across the country. And I don't know. I mean, what if a kid's reading two or three books a month, you know, in the school year, I don't know how much – they have to be speed readers, because they're not really, to me, getting into the books the way that would keep them motivated. It's just a race.
Right.
It's a race to the top.
Do you think that it's possible to be a speed reader and also take in the information?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah, there definitely – I mean – there are kids that can process these. I mean, but this, you're talking about the top percentage, maybe the top 3-5% of kids that can just, you know, fly through books and get a lot out of it. But those are outstanding readers. I'm talking about the majority of students.
Right.
That,
and what about now Shakespeare? Now, which is required reading, but
mm-hmm.
then the argument is that, you know, a lot of the kids can't relate to Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what do you have to say about that?
I can tell you, Andrea, when I was in college, when I took Shakespeare, I still had a hard time understanding
right.
Shakespeare and really couldn't appreciate it. But that with a talented English or reading teacher to make Shakespeare come to life and to modernize it, to put it in contemporary times, that would be the trick in teaching Shakespeare and the language. I mean, the language is, you know, is very, very difficult. And I'm looking at kids, you know, who we're talking about kids that are in college that can't read the textbooks. Then I'm thinking we're going over to them reading Shakespeare and that language, which is, you know, a much more difficult language to get into than a textbook. You know, where are they at, you know, with that? We read Pale Fire by Nabokov in college. And these were like cantos, these like, I don't know, 8-line verses. And it was just impossible. I had such a hard time with that. And when we came back to review the book, I still remember saying, this is like a verbal feast. And I wanted to throw that verbal feast right at his face. You know,
right.
And but he, you know, I mean, he is at these guys, I mean, the poets that I've met from the Teachers and Writers Collaborative in New York, these guys are brilliant guys.
Right.
I mean, they're on another plane of existence and reading, the depth that they get into. You can't compare. So, I mean, that could be done. I mean, I you know, as you say this, Andre, I have a friend that she teaches Shakespeare in elementary.
Really?
And I think they put on a play at a reduced format of the play at the
end. And that would be fascinating to see how she teaches Shakespeare to an elementary student. I find
right.
that fascinating.
Right. So, you know, everything, Andre, any program, my book or whatever education program they have out, it still funnels down to the teacher in front of the room.
But
without the teacher there, a strong teacher, a lot of great programs are going to go fall to the wayside.
But Shakespeare dealt with some heavy topics and a lot of tragedy.
Right.
So that's fascinating that she's teaching that in mm-hmm. elementary school.
Right. But, you know, when you read a lot of these contemplations and the kids' poetry,
right.
I mean, there's a lot of tragedy there. There's
yeah, you're right.
A lot of sadness and a lot of depression and... you know, so the kids can, you know, they can appreciate it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the reading and the reader. And how does a reader develop into a good writer?
Hmm. The reading-writing connection. I talk about both the reading-writing connection and the reverse, the writing reading connection. The point is that if a child is getting into reading, by that again I mean the inner or self motivation, they're visualizing, they're using all the frameworks of the inner eye, ear, the TV screen in the mind, they're getting to the point where they are creating a passion for reading, and when you and a passion for words, that the symbols on a page, the magic of reading, and when you get to the point where you have this level of appreciation and inner motivation, you're going to want to make up your own words and write about things. write about things that you read, or write about things that what you read, what it made you imagine, and get into what an infinite amount of topics. So a reader that develops the inner motivation to read will take him or her into the inner motivation to write. Reading, Andrea, is the translation, in my definition, reading is the translation of words into images, feelings, and thoughts. Writing is the opposite. You're reversing that process. You're taking the images, feelings, thoughts, meanings, and experiences in your mind and translating those or decoding them into words.
Right.
So, yeah, so both, you know, a good reader is going to develop into a writer. A good writer, maybe not a good writer, but will have the desire to write.
Right, and someone who reads a lot probably becomes a good writer,
right,
or at least a decent writer.
Right, yes.
Because
yes,
the two do work hand in hand. It helps you to develop. It's something. But I have to tell you, in looking at your work, I was very excited about it. I said, wow. I bet your classes were very, very exciting for the students. And I think that was a feeling I had after going through all the material that you sent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk a little bit about program highlights, experiences, reflections, insights, and some of the themes from the student contemplations.
Okay. You want to hear some? Do you want to hear some themes, or do you want me to? I could read some contemplations first.
Yeah,
or?
We can do that. But let's talk a little bit about contemplations.
Okay.
That whole, and then yes, we.
Okay.
Because the readings are. Are made. I've just enjoyed reading through the material. What they had to say was so powerful, really.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
But how do you get these kids who are to contemplate, first of all, to just go in within and then to come out with it and express, you know, those inner thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of adults that cannot take that time to get into the quiet and, you know, explore what's going on in their own minds and hearts.
Yeah. Well, you know, when everything, you know, you're speeding through life and your thoughts are speeding, your emotions are speeding, and why stop? You know, because if you stop and reflect, then, you know, you might have to deal with things and what's going on inside yourself. And for a lot of people, that's it's a scary issue. So it's just better to keep, you know, flying along and not looking back.
I mean, certainly if we're busy and overwhelmed and multitasking, then we're not necessarily taking that time to deal with certain things that we may need to deal with, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a big movement now in the schools about contemplation, mindfulness. You know, they're doing yoga.
Right.
Just what you're bringing out here is giving the kids some quiet time just to slow the wheels down and relax. And that's what I have been doing since the 70s.
Of your time, actually, then.
Excuse me?
We're ahead of your time in terms of your approach.
I felt that, well, the big book that came out, Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence, I think it was in 95, and that just brought this whole field out into the open. And but I was doing it in the 70s, and in fact, with this contemplation music writing program, when I was trying to get it published, one of the reviewers for a major company said, there's too much here about feelings.
Right.
And that was just like, I mean, he was clueless about, you know, what was going on in the schools, had really no idea. The only persons who understood what I was talking about were inner city principals.
Right.
Especially what we were talking about, everything that you bring out about the reading process and stuff. They loved that. You know, they knew what the kids needed and understood, you know,
right,
these frameworks. Yeah. But let me explain with the contemplation. As I said, I started it originally just playing music for the kids, and then I added the writing component. And there were no themes given, no topics, no prompts, because again, that's extrinsic motivation and from the outside. And by the way, just in case people are wondering, this is my stuff is all supported by the research where they have found, without going into detail, that intrinsic motivation is more effective than extrinsic motivation. So, and that was a big thing. I never looked at the research, but of anything that I was doing. But in retrospect, when I found out about it, it always agreed, it always supported my projects. Anyway, so I asked them to close their eyes, put their heads on the desk, and just relax and listen to the music. And when the music is over, write about whatever, and that was the key word, whatever you got into. You know, I don't care if it was a dream, a memory, something that happened today, any experience that you had that was rolling through your mind, that's fertile ground to write about in your contemplation.
Right.
And so it started, and I collected the writings. I read it right impromptu right after they did it because I feel it was fresh. Other teachers, you know, other teachers would probably do it differently. They probably take the contemplations home, read them over, and then discuss the writings the next day. I did it right then and there, and I asked them questions about the writing. What was the writer trying to say? What feelings were triggered when you heard this? What pictures did you see? It's the basic approach, and what did it make you think about? Did you ever think about what they were writing? Those were basic questions that I asked the kids about the writing, and this was a collaborative, you know, experience. I call it when the kids talked about these events, a cross-fertilization of ideas. They all learned about their friends' experiences and connected. They could have connected with them or not connect with them, but a lot of times when you have an experience and it's validated by somebody else, you feel a lot better that you're not alone in the world. You know, so this and this is a difficult thing. This is not, this discussion technique is not easy for many teachers, but it can be developed. And the way I get into it in a very detailed manner, so they have a very good idea of how to go about asking questions for each writing.
Yeah. It seems the questions are the key, really, to the right to
yes.
the whole process.
Yeah, but the questions in the contemplation writing process discussion, as well as the book Motivating Teen and Preteen Readers. It's all the answers are important, of course, that the responses that the kids give, but it's also what the teacher can do to expand the responses and get kids to see all the possibilities that are there.
The questions, it's important for the questions to be open questions, correct?
Absolutely.
And
yes.
Not closed questions.
Right, yes. Well, with the contemplations, I tell the kids, as well as, and I'll go back and forth between the book, the reading, about reading, there are no right or wrong answers here.
Right.
And that gives the kids a lot of breathing space and removes a lot of the tension about, I got to get the right answer here. I'm going to make a mistake. And
right.
It does, you know, open them up. This is all about open-mindedness.
Right. Can you give us an example of an open question and an example of a closed question? Because that it's important, I think, for people to understand how to ask questions,
mm-hmm.
you know, to inspire.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to, well, from the motivating teens, most of the questions.
Yeah, whatever you, it just even just something that it doesn't have to be a specific. Just to give our audience an example of what would be a closed question,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
might not be as stimulating and motivating,
mm-hmm.
Versus an open question, which stimulates, inspires, discussion. Do you know what I mean? There's an art to that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the more traditional type of questions came about reading books and novels. Like, what book made you angry that you read? I mean, they have to stick to the theme of, you know, anger and, what triggered that feeling. Let me see. Did you ever think reading was easy? Why or why not? I mean, that's a completely open question. Can an older child help a younger child in reading?
Right.
And that, you know, that can go either way. I've seen that work in the classroom. There are questions, Andrea,
You basically want to kind of avoid the questions where they can say yes or no, I guess.
No. There's no single word answers here. No,
right.
I ask for a 2 or 3 sentence answers, and if they go further into a paragraph, that's fine. But if they give a very short answer and let's say a 1 sentence answer and it's strong, I'll still try to expand it. Especially if it's a good answer, I want the kids to see, you know, what's behind it, and I'll push that, you know, further. But I want them to dig. The purpose is to dig and probe and delve into their reading experiences, and again, that works to their inner or intrinsic motivation.
And I imagine the confidence because it is a key again, because then they feel like, well, what I think, excuse me, how I feel is important. You know, what I have to say is important.
Absolutely. We did a reporter came in and did an article about the poetry and contemplation writing program, and it was called "Making Life a Matter of Meter." It was in the New York Newsday. It was a really beautiful article. And the one thing that he wrote about that impressed him is when he looked around the room, there was a chart, and one of the things about contemplation writing that I wrote is, you know, realize that you have something important to say. You know, and he loved that, what you were expressing was taken seriously. You are making a contribution. You know, we're not worried if it's perfect or right or wrong.
Right. Yeah, that's great. And what about the here and now exercises?
Mm-hmm.
If you could explain.
One of the exercises that I gave you, and I had people scream at me about some of these things that they,
why would they screaming at
said,
you?
It was reviewed by a teacher once, and they just didn't like the approach. I've had when I gave out motivating teen and preteen readers, One person said, a teacher said, and this is her opinion, she said, well, I don't understand how questions, asking kids questions, can motivate them to read. That was her response, you know. And I said, okay, fine. You know,
So what did you say to her, though?
I didn't, you know, I said thank you. I wasn't, she obviously did not get it and did not see the full focus of the book that, you know, we're talking about maybe asking 100 questions throughout the year and kids writing and discussing these responses. And that's, you know, that could be a critique. I mean, reviewers.
I was just thinking, if she asked that, I wonder if she's more traditional in that she stands and she lectures.
Yes.
If you know what I mean. She just stands there. I'm the teacher. This is my lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And give them a test.
Yes. Yes. I've seen people do that.
Yeah.
I've seen people do that with top classes. And, you know, I was speechless. And that you know, they get in their the curriculum, and they're not going to sweat it exactly. But getting back to what you said about the here and now exercises, I gave you one with the staring contest. And to develop the concentration. We used to play a game, again, I don't know if you did this here, called Hit the Penny.
No,
and this is a city, urban game, and you had the boxes on the sidewalk. You put a penny in the middle of two boxes, and you had a Spalding or a tennis ball, whatever, and you try to hit the penny. And that's and you got to focus on the penny, and you know it gets very frustrating when you throw the Spalding 10 times and you're not even close, and your opponent just hit it 35 times. So again, this you get frustrated, and that takes you out of your concentration. You got to be cool, calm, and collected. And to, you know, get your focus to hit that penny, and that's what I want them to do in the classroom. I gave them, I call this the peppermint twist. I gave them a peppermint.
Right.
All right, it's all yours. You can eat in class, and nobody's going to yell at you. And so they sucked on their peppermint, and afterwards I asked them to, and I just said, oh, most important, just concentrate on eating the peppermint. That's all I want you to do. I don't want you to think about anything else, just the peppermint.
Right.
And, you know, again, at the end, I would ask them, well, where was your mind when you were eating that peppermint?
Right.
And did you drift? Did you start thinking about other things? And what happened? And can you describe that? And how did you get back to the peppermint?
Yeah. How did you get back to the peppermint?
Or in one of the exercises, the introductory exercises, we were going off, you know, we were talking about the contemplation and how they got into inner experience. The first exercise that I do with the kids, Andrea, is called the counting exercise. Okay? You read this. So let me explain to the audience. They count backwards from 50 to 1 silently and slowly, and when they're finished, they write about whatever happened. Same purpose, approach that the music writing is. And of course, when you start counting backwards from 50 to 1, well, all sorts of things happen in your head. I mean, and that, it's very difficult to keep your concentration from 50 to 1. It's going to drift. It's going to digress. Take side detours, and all sorts of weird things, you know, come up. I have this here. I have this place laid out here. It's like crazy here. It's I feel like I'm the mad professor here. Here's some of the counting exercises, some of the responses. When I was counting backwards, I saw little numbers passing by and saying hello. My feet fell asleep. I started to move like jelly beans. Every time I would count, the numbers would just disappear. I also saw stars that made me dizzy. At first, I felt scared, but now I don't. when I was counting, I thought about my watch. It was my good luck charm, and I felt sad, and I don't know why. But when I counted numbers 33 and 32, it made me think of my parents, because that is their age. And when I was up to 20, I felt happy, but I don't know why. When I hit the number one, I felt like crying because I missed my best friend.
Wow.
So, you know, and but this is the first step to inner, to introducing them to inner experience. It's there's no rules or regulations, and any, you know, a lot of things that go on inside our heads that we rather not talk about.
Right.
But yeah, so we did this for about four or five times till they understood what inner experience was. And for example, I defined memories, dreams, experiences, mind pictures, flashbacks,
right,
daydreams. So, you know, we had a vocabulary of experience words that they can relate to. Again, another framework so they can understand inner experience. And it helps, you know, light up, illuminate inner experience and where it can go into,
yeah,
into what different events.
Very nice.
Yeah, and but then following the counting, that's when I started playing music for them. And again, I just asked them after the music was over just to write about whatever they got into while the music was playing.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great exercise. So now let's talk about what happened when you contemplated your name. And I thought that was fascinating. And talk about some of the responses when you asked your students
mm-hmm.
to contemplate
mm-hmm.
their name.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, one time a friend of mine, a musician, and a teacher, a very, very, very extremely creative teacher, I got a lot of ideas from him, from a lot of friends that were outstanding motivators that got me into this whole concept of motivation. He calls me up and he starts going, Jeffrey Flom, Jeffrey Flom, Jeffrey Flom, Jeffrey Flom, Jeffrey Flom. I said, stop it, I can't take it. because then all of a sudden the associations come up and half of them I couldn't even verbalize on Andrea. They just, you know, they were all unconscious, but it like, it got me so icky, you know, and I said, let me try it as a what I call a present moment contemplation. So that's what I did. I asked the kids to do the same thing and you know, just keep saying your name silently to yourself for I think about a minute, and then write about what happened. Here's one. I saw in my mind that I was alone in school, and there was fog in the hallway. I heard my name called, and I was scared. I saw a stranger coming towards me, and he said my name. And here's some of the questions here, too, because you were asking about how do you ask questions about this here. And one of the questions reads, what kind of experience does the writer go through? What mind picture pops out from the contemplation? What feelings are expressed? Very simple, very basic things that, you know, it's like reading comprehension. That's all it is, to, you know, extrapolate what the writer is attempting to communicate.
Right.
While I was saying my name, I recognized myself more than before, and I felt happy. What does the writer mean by the sentence, I recognize myself more than before? Why does she feel happy? What mind pictures might she be observing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but this last one here, this is more what I experienced. I couldn't take it. I got confused, mixed up like. I don't know what happened. You know, and here the question is, how many people had a hard time doing this exercise? Why did you have trouble? Give me an example of what happened. What do you think, why do you think the writer got confused?
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the concentration or what I call the present moment contemplations are a practical application of contemplation writing. This comes out of that project. And hopefully from the contemplation writing, they can, you know, handle these tasks and don't get thrown off with the absurdity of them. But you do. You can't help it. And
right.
But the purpose is to bring every time you go off to bring yourself back into the activity. I mean, that's basic meditation, right? When you
right. You
meditate on something and you get distracted, bring your mind back to the meditation.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. So now tell us about the word-a-thon poetry.
this was wild. Well, you have to realize that the word-a-thon poetry came after the kids were taught how to, you know, reading poetry, and we did a lot of reading. Native American, African American. Richard Wright wrote a beautiful haiku, something that a lot of people don't know about him. You know, for other things, Black Boy, his book, I mean, all sorts of things. And he didn't live far. I passed his house on Gates Avenue on the way into Bed-Stuy when I first started teaching. He had lived there, which always interesting. The word-a-thon poetry came, like I said, and they were writing poetry. They were reading it, and they had been writing it. Okay, so they, were very much into it at this point. And I want to tell you, when we did have a newspaper interview from Green Line, it's a local Williamsburg newspaper. I mean, I learned all sorts of things from the kids that I didn't even know, because I just go into it, Andrea. I don't care what they think. You know, if I know and feel that this is going to be good for them, I'm going to go with it. So one of the kids said, the reporter said, well, what'd you think about when Mr. Pham started teaching you this poetry? And I was going to say, well, we weren't exactly sure about this. You know, I said, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, but one of the kids said, who was one of my best, she said that learning to read and write poetry was a privilege, and that broke me down. I said, you don't have to come to school for a few days on that answer.
That's
that was
beautiful.
I couldn't have made up a better answer than that.
It's a privilege, and that's beautiful. Isn't
yeah,
it?
I mean, I was just floored, Andrea. It's just like, whew, God. You know, but with the word-a-thon poetry, I had them cut out from newspapers, magazines, or whatever materials that they could cut out words to cut what I call poetry words, whatever words they think would be good to put together for a poem. And so they spent 2 weeks cutting out hundreds of words, and they came in with, you know, a huge pile of words. And I said, okay, go make a poem. And they came up with just unbelievable stuff. I mean, again, this was so open, Andrea, that, you know, just, you know, arranging and rearranging the words and the lines, as many poets do, even I think of that magnetic poetry, right, where they just, you know, move around with magnets
right.
behind the words and create a poem, which is great. I mean, that's a process. But here's a poem by Dennis Berrios, and he was a character. He was a great kid. This is called Great Peace.
Okay.
Crystal love, open night, you sleep your entire life. Soft, beautiful, and free, care more to future days. Bold speed flies to celebrate our golden mystery. Born to think of the world called imagination, the young great spirit world spurring before your life. This I love. That's just like unbelievable. His prayer. An elderly man gets up on a Saturday to find his life before he dies in the free open sky. In a world of speed, on the star below his God.
Wow.
Here's another. Yourself. Are you yourself when there's people around? Are you yourself when your family's around? Are you yourself when your friends are around? Are you you? Warning, look, see, by Luis Figueroa. Love take heart for everybody, to you and me, so the world would end. Love take heart so we could die. Love take heart so we will cry, by Sheila Torres. But there's one. There's so many here. This one's interesting, Andrea. The new world. The new world is never light. It's a world with no morning, only the night. A land with no seas and people with no memories.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean that. Yeah. So you know, I was like, you know, right. He's got that. He has that right. So. Passion.
Stuff. Go ahead. I love it. Continue.
Yeah, thanks. I'm on your side in every way. I'll grab the earth and the great book that leads to tomorrow's trial. We've got each other.
Great stuff.
Yeah. And here, spirit, you are a healthy life. Create the sunrise and dream on. You know, that to me, that's like a poster. That's like you know, you see with a great photograph and you know, usually a poem or a quotation or something. So I would, but the word-a-thon poetry is really good. But I wanted to get you. There's a couple of poems here that I think are really eerie, and people laugh at me when I say this, but because I felt that they predicted the 9/11, and there's two poems that just.
When were they written?
They were written during the Persian Gulf War.
Okay.
Here, this is by Gleniano, and Glenny is. Glennie is now this. I was telling you, a graduate student at NYU. She has three kids, and she has a fourth coming this month. I haven't called her yet, and I asked her. I said, Glennie, I don't know how you're doing this. She says, I don't know. We like to have kids. And she, I have one. My daughter. If I had one more, I don't know what I would do. Anyway. Glennie was just an absolute incredible poet. This is called I Hear It. I hear crashing, I hear screams, I hear things that you've never dreamed. I see running, I hear crying, all because people are dying. Then I see pictures in my head about the people who are dead.
Wow.
But this one is really eerie, and this is by Juan Serrano, a brilliant student. War windows. At midnight, you hear explosions and screams. You hear air raid sirens because planes are dropping bombs on buildings. And then you look out of a window, and people are lying dead on the streets. While another window shows tanks and soldiers killing or destroying anything in their way. Then the last window, you see a missile coming to your head and all the windows close.
Wow.
I mean, so this
amazing,
was written,
isn't it? It's just amazing.
Yes. This was written in 1990, by the way.
Beautiful stuff, I mean, very powerful and... You know, it's obviously, I mean, they had a lot, you know, in their heart, a lot. on their mind. And
a lot, yeah, right, then right. That's right. Well, you know, and then you know, this is what's missing now, and you know, all the people that are involved in the arts and are screaming and about the you know, they're emptying out those programs and. You know, that's a sad thing. The things I've done in the classroom, Andrea,
right?
I would have a hard time doing this today, be honest with you, and that's sad. But
why do you say that? That you would have a hard time doing it today?
Because the classes consist of a lot of test prepping. They're only really caring about what the scores are, the race to the top, and math and reading, and they're just really not focusing on the motivational aspects, the creativity. Creativity is like is a lost art now, along with motivation.
It's like they're not really focusing on. Teaching and learning. You know, I was going to ask you, and this may be an odd question, you know, but how do we learn how to learn? How do we teach others to learn? And how do we learn from how we teach what we teach? It's actually three questions. But
that's the million-dollar question. You're bringing up this is a key question that you're bringing up. There's two diametrically opposed approaches, which are not, in my opinion, diametrically opposed. One is the Edward Hirsch's of the world about learning subjects, the common core subjects, versus the progressive, the 21st century skills people. In simple terms, you know, you have to learn your subjects, your history, language arts and writing, science and math. This is what it's all about. The 21st century skills people are more about communication, creativity, reasoning, thinking, and teaching these skills. But my approach is that in sports, Andrea, if a kid learns how to play basketball, well, the coach starts teaching them how to pass the ball, how to dribble a ball, how to shoot a ball. You learn fundamentals. And after you learn the basic fundamentals of basketball, then the coach says, okay, today we're going to play a game. We're going to scrimmage. And we're going to use these fundamentals that I taught you in practice. We're going to use those in a game. In any sport, tennis, same thing. You learn a forehand, a backhand, a serve, a volley. You practice that with a coach. Then you go out and put all these skills together in a game. Education is the same exact thing. You have to learn skills, what I call the prerequisite fundamental skills for learning and learning how to learn. Again, to go back, concentration, visualization, recall. This is, you know, recall is a big thing. I mean, we don't even think about memory, but with kids having an attention span of 30 seconds, you better believe that teaching recall and memory is serious. Contemplation, reflection, analysis, synthesis, all these creative thinking, critical thinking. To me, these skills have to be taught as separate lessons. And then once the kids get a nice menu of these skills, then they have the skills to learn and for learning how to learn. And then they can go in and attack history books and appreciate what's in the books and think about math problems and visualize math, verbal problems, and, you know, and think critically about solving problems. And that, and to me, that, and that's not done.
So would you say now? So a lot of these programs, these wonderful classes, are being taken away now with the cutbacks and all. So, what does that mean for our future? And you know, in the classroom for our students,
it's not
for our world, really.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not spelling a good ending. But you know, Andrea, there's also the problem goes further. Many times we hear complaints about teachers now, and that's like a big item, teacher bashing. And I don't think it's a fair thing. I mean, there are certain teachers that shouldn't be anywhere near kids. That's true, but. The teachers are not, I feel, are not getting trained in the right areas when they're in undergraduate school or graduate school. And they're not learning enough about emotional intelligence and creativity, imagination. It's not happening. The things that reflection, mindfulness, these should be part of the their ed courses. And a big part of it, because they have to learn these skills themselves, and then go on and teach it to the kids. So it's still, you know, on the teacher's head to you know, get those skills across to the kids, and they're not, you know, the graduate schools are still, you know, they're still behind,
right.
And they're not moving forward with any new ideas.
Yeah. So what advice do you have for new teachers, teachers that are just starting out?
One other skill that I, which is a difficult skill for many kids that go into inner city schools, they can't relate or they can't communicate. I think that the biggest thing, the kids know who's with them and who doesn't care. A lot of teachers don't, you know, they think, oh, you know, they don't know anything. But the kids know. The kids know who the teachers are. And my biggest thing that I would say to a young teacher is to, you know, think about your communication with the kids and, you know, how much effort, you know, you're putting into this. And also, I would tell them to do what I did: make things up. You know, make it fun for yourself. You know, put together some of your own creative lessons or whatever lessons in history, and something, you know, different that's not a part of the Common Core curriculum. Something that you're really into, and to get the kids' creative juices or intellectual juices flowing.
Because it really is a learning process for both the teacher and the student, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I you know, the people ask me, well, what do you teach the kids today? And I say, no, it's what the kids taught me today, because from them I learn about what I can teach them and what I could create for lessons. Absolutely, it's a two-way street.
What would you say is the greatest lesson you've ever learned, you know, from teaching and, you know, developing your own creative approach?
I would have to think a long time to answer that. There's probably a thousand things, Andrea, to answer you on that. But I would just say that you have to keep an open mind. It's all about peripheral vision and sideways thinking, lateral thinking, and looking at the possibilities, that there's always different ways, you know, to teach something that's, let's say, not going over well, and you have to be constantly thinking. I laugh at a book that I saw called Painless Reading Comprehension. Well, I wish that I can make reading comprehension painless, but it's not. It's not easy to do. I mean, thinking. I have to think on this here.
Right.
Yeah. One publisher said to me, said, you know, when teachers get their books, they just want to open the box and hand it out and just start working with the books.
Right.
But, you know, and he was totally frustrated. You want the kids, you want to challenge the kids, and you want the kids to think critically. Well, if you ain't doing it on your end, then what, you know, what's happening?
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, just the work that you've been doing is just exciting, and the students who were fortunate to have you for a teacher, wonderful.
Yeah, no.
So tell us about the Teachers Writers Collaborative.
Oh. Teachers Writers Collaborative is here in New York. They've been around for almost 30 years. I was trying to get the kids' poetry published through them, and they said, "Well, they have their own poets and writers that go into the schools, and they get their own collections from these writers." And they asked me if I have any articles about the programs that I've been doing, if I want to write about them. And these are the articles that I had sent you on contemplation writing and here and now, 9 meditative writing ideas. They had people like Kenneth Koch, who recently passed away, the poet, and he wrote Rose, Where Did You Get That Red?, teaching inner city kids how to write poetry, and Wishes, Dreams, and Lies, another poetry book for teaching kids, and which these are the books that I used that got me into the whole process of teaching poetry. And because he just made it like, you know, you could do it. I come from the school of I hate poetry. I don't want to hear Nabokov's Pale Fire cantos again in my life. This showed me that there is a way to teach kids poetry and to, you know, have a good time with it and convey that to the kids, which worked. And they're just a great organization. They keep it's a nonprofit, and they've been doing this for so many years. And they have outstanding people in the schools. They send the poets in for an 8 to 10 week stretch, and they teach the kids poetry.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the book, and it's just amazing. Here's I'm going to read a couple.
Mm-hmm.
This one is, fear is something each of us carries inside of ourselves every day of our lives. When you're little, you're scared of the dark. When you're old, you're scared of death. You can be afraid of scary movies, and you can have the fear of getting hit by a baseball when batting. You fear going to sleep one day and not knowing if you're going to get up the next. There's the fear of not knowing whether you're going to win or lose a big game. You can have the fear of nightmares when you wake up at 3 a.m. all sweaty and anxious to go back to sleep. That's something that gets you to do childish things like sleeping with the lights on. It's like smoking cigarettes or doing drugs. Once you do it again and again. The idea is to not let the fear take you over. You overcome the fear.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then, and that was someone by the name of Francisco who wrote that. And then there's, when I closed my eyes, I saw a dream I once had. It was about me and 20 other people who were on a train that kept riding and riding. I looked out the window and watched the houses passing by. Suddenly, the train began going faster and faster. There was no engineer. The train was out of control. The only way out was to jump. The train kept going and going. Each time, 5 people jumped and landed safely. Soon, there were no more people left except myself. The train passed my house. I jumped to safety and went home. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so powerful. And here's another one. As the music played, the walls started to come in on us. We all started screaming. Finally, we were in the middle of the room. The wall suddenly stopped moving, and right over us, a bright light appeared. It was like the sun over us. We tried to look for the door, but there was no way out. One of the children said, "Why don't we try to climb into the bright light?" So we did. We ended up on the roof of the school. Everyone said, "Let's jump." So we did, and landed safely. We all decided to go home. But when each of us got to our house, there was no one home. As a matter of fact, there was no one anywhere. It was just us. And we all met at the front of the school and stood there, frightened. Amazing.
Yeah. It's very real, and, you know, that came out of a real experience, as the dream did, and as the fear contemplation that you read. These are things that, you know, really was stuck in the kids' minds and imaginations, and the detail there is just, you know it's real, and no prompts were given. That's to me the beauty of that.
Yeah, it is beautiful. And here's one. I really got into the music. I fell into a very good mood. I felt like dancing. I was really relaxed. It was great. The music burned a smile on my face. It just woke me up. I felt like the music was inside of me. It lit up my day. I mean, if it wasn't for the music, I wouldn't get into anything. I never thought that contemplation could be this much fun.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just beautiful, and that was Irvin.
Mm-hmm. Irvin was a trumpet player, a very talented musician, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really special that you were able to inspire this creativity and this openness and expression. What a beautiful thing to teach people how to be open. And it certainly does open you up as well, right? As you try to get them to open, then you become more open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say was the greatest lesson for you? I'm sure you had many that you learned. The greatest lesson that you learned from doing this work and doing it your way. I mean, because you actually found your way to get children, students to open up, to get excited about reading, comprehending, being open and learning, and then writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just what you said, you mentioned it a few times, them opening up and me opening up, that keeping things open for them. And because they're used to, okay, let's have a composition today. Let's write about a tree, you know, or let's write about the building next door. They're always used to getting prompts or a big buildup before writing anything. And I just took the rug out from under them and left it. It's all yours. So it's all on your mind and imagination. And, you know, and it goes back to you have something important to say, and it's all in there. And it's amazing what you can fish out. That's just dropping a line in and, you know, opening up the darkness of the imagination and seeing the imagery, the richness, the inner landscape that's there. It's in you. It's not. Don't be fooled by the Disney productions, which are great, and all the video games, which is the imagination personified right in front of your eyes. You have the same thing inside you. A lot of times in their early contemplations, kids would write about all the video games. And again, at this time, the Mutant Ninja Turtles. I said, don't write, you know, I said, well, we'll get beyond Mutant Ninja Turtles. I want to know what's in you and not the latest movie that you saw. And, you know, give yourself credit for having a vast inner life.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Really beautiful. Yeah. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Do you have anything to share that we have not covered at all? We covered quite a bit. There's always more, right, Jeffrey?
No, I mean, I, you know, you really, we covered the book and the poetry and the contemplations, and this is, you know, wonderful. We really did everything that we wanted to get out, and I mean, there are other programs, and there of course, they, you know, I just gave you the tip of the iceberg in terms of the contemplations. There are follow-ups, evaluations, where I give the kids a contemplation, and they have to analyze it. I give them 4 or 5 questions, and they have to answer them. I make it into, I hate to say it, like a reading comprehension exercise, but to prove that, to me, that they were into the contemplation writing or music writing when they were doing it, and that they listened during the discussions, because the questions that you have to answer for each contemplation, you know, make you work and think about what a writer is trying to express.
Right.
I gave them contemplation revision. I think this is from a movie, you know, where a kid wrote a love letter. I can't think of the name of the movie, Andrea. Yeah, I'm sure you'd know it if you heard it. But I think the kid gave the teacher a love letter, and the teacher corrected it. And gave it back to him. I can't think of it for the moment. But I also, again, it's academic, but what I did was I photocopied a contemplation that's, let's say, a paragraph long, at least 8-10 sentences, and I said, here, you correct this. So we did it first on the board. We practiced a collaborative revision on the board, and I talked to them about sound and sense. How does it sound? Does it sound right when you hear it? And we went through a bunch of lessons like that, and then I gave them the contemplations, and I gave them red pens, which we don't use red pens anymore because it's such a negative connotation. But I gave the kids red pens, and they loved it. They just, you know, crossed out everything and revised the writing. They loved it, you know. After getting hit with red pens and corrections for years from other teachers, you know, they had a chance to, correct a paper.
Yeah, I'm just looking at all these different reflections, and just contemplations. They're just so beautiful, just amazing, just going through it.
The themes, I think I sent you the contemplation writing themes, and again, they if I have a minute, I'll just read you a few.
We have plenty of time. Feel free. It's really quite moving.
Yeah.
Material here is just amazing.
Yeah. All right, let me explain this here. These are themes from student contemplations. Now, these are not themes that I put on the board and said to the kids, write about this.
Right.
In other words, I read their contemplation and I culled the theme from, you know, in a brief sentence or phrase. I got the main idea of the contemplation, and it called it a student theme. Money can't buy happiness. Nobody wants me or becoming a Snickers bar. Physical problems, irrational fears of a doll. Running away from the unknown, friends, loneliness, rejection, pressure, and school, that's one. Loving relationships, boy and girl. Dream the impossible dream. Reflections and present moment anger. drifting away into a peaceful world, parent-child split, losing a friend, dream of being lost on an airplane, unfulfilled dream of the good life, rejection, I'm nobody, who are you, neglected child, symbolic trip through a mountain, life is short, death of a friend. I mean, it goes on and on. I think I sent you about 200 of these themes, and I have like 8,000 more contemplations that would go on. I mean, they're so specific, Andrea. I mean, that's the thing, and that's what self-expression is about, and writing is about, to get to, you know, details and specifics and really hone in on these experiences. So, I mean, it's without prompts.
Yeah, it's really. And what kind of feedback did you get from the students?
I wish I had the. What I did, Andrea, was at the end, I think twice a year, I handed out what's called the student contemplation questionnaire.
Right.
And I asked them a series of questions about the contemplation writing and what it did for them. I'm not sure if I have them exactly out in front of me, but for instance, I would ask them, what contemplation do you remember? What feelings were triggered throughout the contemplations? And I didn't even tell you how I did this, which would help. The kids did it on 4x6 index cards. So when they finished, let's say, 50 contemplations, I would give them back their cards, and they would reread them. And I gave them, an hour, or I let them take it home so they have a more careful, a longer reading. And one of the first question was what feelings and thoughts did you get into after rereading your contemplations? And basically they said, I can't believe I wrote this. I learned so many things about myself. A lot of the kids said that they felt that the contemplation writing improved their reading, which I asked them about. I said, how? And they said, well, because of the mind pictures and the visualization we did in contemplation, I could take it to reading and do it in when reading a book.
Right. This is so beautiful. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple myself.
Yeah. Sure.
Here's one called The Fall. I fall through a big hole full of feelings. I am yelling. I look down, and it is unlimited, endless, eternal, boundless, everlasting. I keep falling straight down, 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 like a boulder, down a mountain. I look and see the ground coming up to my feet, and I go right through the bottom. So the only hope is to live and fall, fall and live.
Hmm.
And that was Anthony.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Anthony was an unbelievable artist. Absolute. He drew things that absolutely were incredible. And he could write as well.
Yeah, obviously. It's beautiful. Here's one from Glennie. I imagined a beach in the night. I saw the left side and I looked like a black shade. And it looked like a black shade, the right side, too. Over the middle of the beach was a full moon. The middle appeared to be dark blue, and the sea was black. You could see the moon's reflection on the dark water. There were only a few stars out that night. It's weird, because I started picturing flowers coming out of the sea, and then a soft breeze hit me in my face. Yeah, I love this. I mean, I was like, wow. And then Mask of Hidden Self.
Mm.
You remember that?
Yes.
Ishmael, yeah.
Yes.
The mask of lies is put to the mind, leaving the truth behind. Truth is just knowing your cold-hearted self. the person you see will make you say, that can't be me, but you know it's true. It is you. Wow.
I don't know, Andrea. I mean, I gave them some stuff, you know, but what Ishmael was also, this kid was a brilliant student. I mean, he just, boy, you know, but right.
Jeffrey. I really think it sounds like you had quite a few brilliant students. And this one, I think, is really rather appropriate for a closing reading. I mean, there's so many here. It's just, they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the slides Mr. Flom had shown us earlier. I imagined myself in those beautiful mountains. I had to get through them as if they were a maze. I saw the mountains look like a dragon, and from another angle, a face. I went beneath the big, gigantic mountain and found a huge hole that a 10-foot person could fit through. I went inside, and it was dark and ugly. On the other side was light, and I got out of that thought.
You know, I have to say, when you read them now, when you read them, and you read it so well, I mean, I'm hearing this on another whole other level that I don't think I really experienced before. You know, because I'm reading it to myself and listening to you, I'm just hearing and feeling just a whole new experience.
Right, because it's special. And it's, you know, what a wonderful thing to know that you help to inspire this sort of openness and communication. You know, and it's something that we can all learn to do. And it's important for all of us to be able to, at some point, have that kind of openness of heart and spirit and to feel comfortable and safe to share. It's just such a wonderful feeling and to inspire that. And I'm sure that the experience will live with these students forever.
And me.
Yeah, and you. I'm sure you were deeply touched by it.
Yes.
So I was really moved when you sent it to me and was happy that you sent it to me and enjoyed reading it, as you could tell.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you had a chance to actually listen to what you helped to inspire. And that's really what it's about, isn't it? Trying to help to bring out the best in people.
Right.
And certainly when you do that, it does make learning exciting, doesn't it? And memorable.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes.
And that's the connection, because you talked about how important it is to feel connected. And when you feel connected, it inspires you. And you do learn, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You learn when you feel connected.
It's got to be an inside feel, and that's the connection. And that's so important. So many of the kids are apathetic, and they're unmotivated, and they're totally bored.
Right.
Although one time a cops came in with a drug prevention program, and they said, "Well, do you find everything boring?" You know, so everybody raised their hands. You know, but then the cops said, "Well, are you boring yourself?" And that floored me. And that's true. They have no interest. They have a kid. Not everybody. Kids. They have no curiosity. No wonder. And no concentration, and they're bored.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful work. Motivating teen and preteen readers, how teachers and parents can lead the way. Beautiful book, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Flom. Amazing work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for great questions and a great interview. It made me feel really special myself here.
Well, you are special. You're doing, I mean, look at what you've inspired, you know, And that's what's so great about the work that you're doing, is that you've just inspired people to be open, and that's great. And when you inspired that openness, they were learning. So, and you were learning too, and it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So people should visit www.jeffreyflaum, spelled P-S-L-A-U-M, .webs.com, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they can also go to www.romaneducation.com.
Yeah, for the book, right. Yeah, it's on Amazon as well, and Barnes & Noble. And
okay.
It's also a Kindle. It's an e-book.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing, for what you've inspired. It's very, very special.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Have a great night.
You too, Andrea.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
I'd like to thank our guest, author Jeffrey Flaum, for being here to give us valuable information on how we can motivate teens and preteens to read. For more information, visit www.romaneducation.com and www.jeffreyflaum.webs.com. And you can find the book, Motivating Teen and Preteen Readers, on Amazon, and just Google it and do whatever you do, but you can find it, and it's amazing work. And it's been very wonderful. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, here, Online with Andrea. Make sure you join me next time here on Blog Talk Radio, the citizen's voice on the Internet, taking radio to a new interactive and expansive level. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others. And never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Thank you so much for listening to Andrea Garrison. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.